Hi, Chief Halton here at Fire Engineering Podcasts, and we are being brought to you by Tenkata Protective Fabrics and their Made for Life podcast hosted by Stuart Perry. The Made for Life podcast unearths the work experiences of real men and women who rely on the protective clothing and equipment to get the job done. From firefighters to industrial workers to military personnel, recent episodes explore the dangers and challenges of wildland firefighting, peer counseling for first responders, and the ins and outs of turnout gear. It's the Made for Life podcast from Tenkata Fabrics. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And thank you for listening to Fire Engineering.
Well, welcome to Firefighter Behavioral Health, tonight with Dr. Beth Murphy. This is John Murphy, her panel controller person. I guess there must be a better name than that, but that's the way it is. And so Dr. Murphy has some very interesting items to talk about as it deals with firefighter behavioral health. But a couple of administrative things right now is, one, remember FDIC in Indianapolis, August 2nd through 7th. Also, iWomen's conference will be in conjunction with that. And then there's always the hot classes early and then the lectures in the afternoon. And hopefully you can make it. And it'd be good to get back together. We've been in this quarantine for such a long period of time that it will be refreshing to get out amongst our brother and sister firefighters and listening to some of the world's best lecturers from our country and from around the world. Next is the issue of the building collapse down in Miami-Dade County. We wish and pray for the safety of all those rescuers that are down there putting their lives on the line looking for those who have been lost. Miami-Dade has probably one of the best track records of urban search and rescue, and is a premier provider of that service, not only nationally but internationally. But it's a dangerous occupation and adventure, and working in an unstable building like that, we send you our prayers. And for those of you who are on the East Coast and those of you who are on the West Coast, the weather is always a factor. So out here in the Seattle area, we're expecting to get over 100 degrees this weekend. And in the East Coast, it's pretty hot, stormy, and the typical weather that we see in the United States. So as firefighters, brothers and sisters, let's be careful out there. And without further ado, I present to you Dr. Beth Murphy.
Hi. Thank you, John, for that wonderful introduction, and also for the acknowledgement of what's going on in Florida. So that's a tough thing for anybody to go through. So I hope that they find more people and that everybody is getting the help that they need. So it's a very stressful situation, to say the least. I didn't hear the very first thing that you had said prior to that, though.
It had to do with FDIC, August 2nd through the 7th.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Great. Yes. Okay. So, obviously, my wonderful dashboard handler, John Murphy, my husband, and amazing lawyer and physician assistant, and with everything he does, he's good at everything, except for one thing, and that's retirement. So if you're going to be good at anything and not good at one thing, let it be retirement.
Thank you.
So I know. And he has a lot of fun. So his retirement, in air quotes, has done really well for him.
I don't do retirement very well.
Yeah, no. And that's something I always tell people. I'm like, my husband is so good. When I tell him what he does, then they're always like, whoa, overachiever. I'm like, yeah, right. I said, there's only one thing he's ever failed at, and that's retirement, which they think is really funny. So may that be in your future for anybody that's listening, is that you're not very good at retirement and you're filling it full of endeavors of whatever your interests are. So, which I don't know, it kind of ties into what I'm going to talk about tonight, but kind of not really. If you knew how my brain worked and could see inside of it, you would go, oh yeah, I totally get it. But I think it's a scary place in my brain sometimes. So basically, I am going to be, I'm going to be talking about, I guess it's like kind of a continuation of the last time I did a show. So, and that show was really about kind of like this shift that I am making in kind of my thought process and in my focus on things. And so this is a continuation of that. And hopefully it provides a few pieces of information that you will find helpful. So basically, this has been a journey for me, and I'm going to talk about this from a little bit from my perspective and how I came about things, and also the stuff that has been brought to me by other people, because I am a lifelong learner. I mean, and so is my husband, which is part of why he fails at retirement, because he's constantly learning and putting himself out there. And I am the same way, although I really think he's got a lot more energy than I do, and I'm younger. So basically, I've been on this journey of understanding, we'll put it that way. And that's kind of what drew me into psychology. And if you've listened to my show or we've had discussions, then you might know that my doctoral dissertation was on women firefighters' experience of stress on the job. And the reason that I did that was part of this, you know, I guess maybe this was like the journey, the beginning of the journey of understanding, because I was not really satisfied with what I was finding out there. And so, and this was like a long time ago, way back. I'm finding I'm saying way back when more often, which it kind of, it's funny because that's like what my grandparents used to say. So way back in the day, or way back when. So way back when. When I was a firefighter, I was recognizing that I was having an experience in the fire service that was different from my husband. I went into the fire service for a lot of reasons, but you know, the picture that my husband painted about the fire service made it sound like, ooh, this is where I want to be, except my experience there was vastly different than his, and that was for a lot of reasons. And I remember thinking it would, or questioning, is it just me? Excuse me. So it's like, is it just me? Am I just like oversensitive? And I'll be the first person to admit I am sensitive. I am very sensitive. But that's my empathy, and it's what makes me good at my job. And so, you know, I'm pretty good at channeling it, but anyway, it's like, am I being oversensitive? And am I the only one that experiences what I'm experiencing? So that was kind of the beginning of my questioning. And then there were other questions. So I became part of peer support, and I just felt dissatisfied with the model, and I know, so the CISD model or the Mitchell model, it's I think that I don't know him, and I actually have never met him. I think it would be great to meet him and have a conversation with him, but I haven't had that pleasure. But the way that model was taught to me and the way it was employed, it just seemed to leave a lot out. And I guess, maybe it was supposed to. But I was recognizing that there was a lot more going on with people, and not everybody responded to the calls the same way. So, you know, sometimes people were bothered and sometimes they weren't. So I questioned. And so I've had people along the way that have kind of helped me form better questions and finding answers. And so, you know, that's what I've been doing, asking questions, finding answers. And at that time, the research specific to firefighters and first responders was actually pretty lean. So there was a paucity of research. And for women, virtually nothing. So I was actually doing something with my research that was expanding knowledge, which is actually pretty cool. But there were still questions. And then I got involved eventually in speaking at FDIC, and that was a pleasure to do so. And I still remember the first time being out in Lucas Oil Stadium in one of the little rooms underneath. And it was like, that was all right. I honestly expected there only to be like four people. I guess that would have been four people, including myself, but I was expecting like John and then Chip and Chip Comstock. So he's one of the attorneys that is, talks with John, and then and Brad. Oh, Brad and Nicole. And honestly, I don't remember if they were actually there. There was talk about them being there, so I'm not quite sure. Anyway, I didn't really expect anybody. So I think there were like eight people that first time, and they had questions, and I had some answers and more questions. Things kind of grew from there, and I talked more and more about mental health and my understanding from the research, and basically, and this is a real simplified, I guess, statement related to the findings, but it's like there are a lot of stressors that present themselves in the fire service. And the calls, at least from the research, were not accounting for those stressors. I mean, the stressors were, like, the calls were listed as one of the stressors, but they were not endorsed as being the biggest problem. It was other things. And that was actually pretty consistent in the research early on. But the fire service wasn't really, I mean, they were having a hard time talking about it because you're not supposed to have feelings when you're at work. So you deal with stuff and you deal with those, and I say in air quotes, horrific things, because what horrifies people, or that definition of what's horrific, is a shared consensus. So it's not necessarily a personal definition. I mean, it could be awful for one person, but horrific for another. And that means the reaction could be, oh, that was really bad and that was hard. And you might have some emotion attached to it, like, well, that's sad that happened, and that shouldn't happen. To, where you might want to fall to your knees and cry, But the fire service didn't allow space for any of those reactions. So that was something that I recognized was kind of a problem. It was more not the calls, but the space allowed to process those calls. And you might think, oh, but what about CISD? Well, it's like those often turned into post-incident analysis where people would examine what they did right and what they did wrong. And it really wasn't about like, well, you could have done something more or something different. It's kind of like, well, how did you feel you did? And then having an opportunity to have somebody kind of correct that sense of feeling ability. And that didn't always happen because you need to allow space for some feeling. And some people just didn't feel comfortable with having the feeling or expressing the emotion. So I felt like there was something lacking. I kept talking about it, kept asking questions. Other people talked about it, and research started happening, and more was coming out. And I don't know, like, if you're listening to this, I don't know what state you're in or where your state is at regarding presumptive laws related to mental health. But Washington State has a PTSD presumptive law. And I think that that's both amazing and short-sighted. So it's amazing because it's recognizing that the stress of the job, whatever that stress is something that can overwhelm a person and lead to a mental health problem. Now, Washington State, it has to be PTSD to fall under the presumptive law. The problem with that is that a lot of people don't get to that point until they're like really, really in crisis. So being exposed to long-term stress and not having ways to deal with it and not being supported can lead to like anxiety or depression and, yes, eventually PTSD. So I think we still have a long way to go. And then there's other stuff attached to it that is really convoluted that always gets my ire up. But that's not really for this talk. So I'm glad that we're there. So I see a lot of first responders who have a workers' comp claim, and so we work on the issues that contribute to that, and then sometimes people go to treatment centers. So I know some people have gone to the IAFF Center of Excellence. There's another one, Deer Hollow. There's I wish I could remember it, but I know that there's one there's actually two in California. One of them is post-traumatic stress or Center for Post-Traumatic Stress, something like that. And it was one that was in existence earlier. So there are places for people to go. And a lot of them actually will start with the stressors of the job, but then take it back to earlier times. So previous experience, because that's really where the foundation is for how we experience our subsequent experiences. So everything is built on something that came before. So it's like there's been a lot of great things going on, but the talk is still around the psychopathology, like what is wrong? What are the signs that something's wrong? What are the signs and symptoms and how do we treat it and so forth? And I, in my to learn. I have expanded on that learning. And so, and I'm like jumping ahead for a second. So there's one more thing I have to say is that I found with working with first responders, I can't start out saying, tell me how you feel about that. Because if I want to talk about emotions, usually that's met with some eye rolls, and then I never see them again. And I know that. So it's not like I've had anybody leave because I wanted to talk about feelings. But I have had firefighters come in and go, I am not talking about my emotions. And I'm like, okay. So what I do is I ask them what they think, and then I use emotional language. So we still talk about their emotions. They just don't realize it at the time. So that's one of my tricks, so don't tell anybody. It's like my brain is kind of all over the place. I'm really excited about this. So dealing with guys, it's like I kind of had to figure out a way to talk about things. Because the usual emotional language and the standard like cognitive behavioral stuff, it really went over like a lead balloon. So I had to find a different way to talk about it. You know, one is I needed to find a way to overcome the stigma. And I think that's one of the things that my talks at FDIC and FRI and with different fire departments, it's been about let's talk about this. Let's just talk about it. And then there are more people who actually are coming out of the fire service and they're talking about it. And so we're talking about it, which is amazing, but it's still a conversation that is around the negative, the what's wrong, and you know, how do we fix what's wrong. So I just, you know, that left me with something being unsatisfied. And then in questioning, well, why do some people struggle and other people don't? And that was a question that I would get from some of my clients. You know, why is this happening? I'm weak. I must be weak because I can't handle it and nobody else is having problems. And so that would be a statement, and that really speaks to the stigma, is this sense that if you're struggling with, if you're struggling with a stress reaction, whether you have a mental health issue, whether you're experiencing anxiety, depression, or acute stress disorder, or PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, it's always seen as a weakness, or being emotional. I've had guys question why, when they did do a debriefing, why they were making a big deal out of it and some people were upset by it, they weren't. And then the question is, well, what's wrong with me that I'm not upset by this? And that goes back to what I was saying, is it's like that idea of what's defined as horrific and then that sense of horror. Some people will be horrified and have a sense of horror or some other strong emotional reaction to it. And some people won't. And that really is an individual thing. I mean, I can't point to somebody and say, you're going to be horrified and you're not. But so people would say, well, I'm not bothered by this. You know, I did my job. I know I did the best that I could. And the outcome, unfortunately, was bad. And yeah, it was a sad situation. And it shouldn't have happened or whatever, you know, but it's like they recognized they didn't cause it and they did what they were supposed to do. They did what they were trained. And so they're not really struggling. And other people are, and they question, you know, what they did or what they could do different or or it sends them on a quest to learn more and be better overall. So that was a big, that has been a common statement and a question. You know, it's like, why do some people have a problem with whatever in the fire service, and why not others? And then the idea that being emotional or having emotion or struggling in any way is a weakness. And that has been something that I have really tried to answer that question for people, because that's how you decrease stigma and get more buy-in to the, you know, to taking care of your mental health. And then probably the last thing that really contributed to everything, and well, I guess it's, you know, so that last thing about wanting to explain why people handle things differently, that kind of put me on the quest to understand the physiology, or the neuroscience, neurobiology of stress, the stress reaction, mental health issues, learning, motivation, all that, you know, I mean, all that sort of stuff. Well, and ADHD too, which I talked about that before. And so that got me into like wanting to learn more about neuroscience in general. And then that led me to, you know, like mindset, and how does your mindset influence, how you work and how you handle things at work. And so these things like started to like kind of open up the doors in my brain and I wanted to learn more. And then that started to lead me into, like positive psychology and to, well, we actually, and I talked about it a little bit, but into, it led me into resilience. And then, because of like a question my husband had got, and what I talked about last time was the like stress inoculation, which is something, it's a type of training that like, you know, the elite military engages in, like the Navy SEALs or the Rangers. And that then led me to the last piece. And that was remembering my experiences when I was working as a firefighter and getting injured. And the orthopedic surgeon that I dealt with, he referred to me as an elite athlete, which is honestly, it's like I was highly athletic and I was very good and I was extremely fit, but it never occurred to me that I was an elite athlete, because it's like I wasn't going to the Olympics. I wasn't getting paid. You know, whatever it is you think an athlete, elite athlete is. And so every time I saw him, and believe me, I saw him a lot, or I mean, for good, bad, or otherwise, that's how he always referred to me. And so then thinking about that and then, you know, the Navy SEALs and the stress inoculation, I mean, because I can't think of, okay, and there are probably other military branches that would disagree, but it's like when I think like elite teams, I Navy SEALs always come up, but I know that there are others, and I'm sorry, so don't yell at me. But I'm like, oh, okay, this is all coming together. And so what is coming together really is that we need to look at ourselves as, I mean, like if you're in the fire department, then if you look at yourself as an elite athlete, how would you do things differently? And I realized that if I say, yes, firefighters are elite athletes, you might look at yourself and go, no way. Or you might look to somebody that you work with and go, there's no way that guy's an elite athlete. But at some point, they were. And And there are reasons that people quit taking care of themselves as if they're an elite athlete. You know, it's like if you take, and I don't know if this analogy will work, but in my brain it works. It's like if you take a, you know, high-end Porsche and you run the, you know, the super premium fuel, the, I guess, super unleaded or whatever in it, then it's going to run better than if you start giving it the cheap generic unleaded. And so basically you can take a high-end car and make it run like some junker. And it's like, so why, you know, why would you do it in that case? It's like, well, maybe you don't have the time or the money to care for the vehicle the way that it should be, that you had intended to. And I think that that is kind of what happens when people go into the fire service and they're dealing with the job and all the stuff that goes with the job and their own life and all the stuff that happens in life, you know, and it could be the good stuff and the bad stuff. And before you know it, you're like feeding yourself junk and not working out as much as you should and not taking the time to de-stress from your time at work or whatever it is. Maybe you're not giving yourself time to take a breath and to feel whatever emotion you're feeling in the moment. And then, you know, things just kind of go downhill from there. So when you care for other people, you sometimes forget to care for yourself. And I can't tell you how many times I will make that observation, and it pretty much is every firefighter I've ever worked with, that observation fits. I will get some variation of a statement related to, well, if I take care of myself, I'm being selfish. And then, of course, that means I use the analogy related to, well, you have to put your oxygen mask on first, which obviously relates to the plane and the instructions when you're on a plane. And the plane gets into trouble and the oxygen mask drops. You are supposed to put it on yourself first, and then you help the child or the person that can't do it. So, and it's true. It's true, period, in life. I mean, yes, there are some times where you put other people's needs first. There are many times that you have to take care of yourself, because if you don't, you're not going to be able to help other people. And every time you put other people first and you put yourself last, or maybe you don't even get to yourself, then you start carrying a heavier, heavier load. And that's when people start to get into trouble. I mean, that's one of the reasons why. Some people can handle a lot. Some people can't. It really depends on what you do with it. Not that you experience a lot or you don't experience a lot or you try and shelter yourself from stress. It's how you think about it. It's what you do with it. And that's where, you know, this more positive focus comes into play, because it's understanding how stressors stimulate your stress reaction. And what that means in the body, like from a physiological point of view, and if you know what happens, you have some knowledge that allows you to shift your mindset. So, and I've talked about this before, and I mentioned Kelly McGonigal and her TED Talk, How to Make Stress Your Friend. And that was one of those talks that I listened to that was just mind-blowing for me, because it really reinforced the idea that what you think and how you think can impact your body at the biological level. And that was something that was reinforced when I was working at a pain clinic, and we well, I watched people come in and where they basically were told by that this is the last ditch effort. You have to do this work before we can do anything else. And I've watched people come in all stooped over and just pissed off that they had to be there. And of course, you know, the first week they're there, they're not getting anything out of it because they're just so pissed off and so sure that there's nothing that's going to help them. And you know what? If that is what you're thinking, then that's exactly what's going to happen, is nothing's going to help you. So again, he was taken aside and he basically was counseled, and it's like, this is the last ditch effort. You're not showing any more improvement. And that is what they call maximum medical improvement. That doesn't mean that you've gotten as good as you're going to get, and that's good. It's like, you're not getting any better. And if you're bad off and you haven't made improvement, that's maximum medical improvement. And you know, at least Washington State workers' comp could be the end of your benefits. So this guy, because he was so sure that he needed to have one more surgery to make things happen, he was like, okay, fine, I'll work it. I will do this program. And part of the program was mobility, flexibility, and strength building. And movement. In fact, there was a sign on the wall called, and it said, "Motion is the lotion," which always brings up a couple images for me. And one of them is Silence of the Lamb. And so that was a big part of it. And then the other part of it was, you know, obviously like vocational type stuff. And then there was the psychological piece. And this is where we talked about cognitive behavioral therapy. So, you know, recognizing your thoughts and understanding how much power your thoughts have on how you feel. And then on relaxation, because when you get tense, your muscles tense. When your muscles tense, wherever you're hurting worse. And the body is designed to tense up to protect injured areas. And the body doesn't always know that, well, the body doesn't know. Like if you're experiencing pain, it might as well be a new injury. It's what we think about it. So it's our brain and our thoughts that tells our body, oh, look, this is an old injury. This is not a new injury. It hurts, but it's not injured. So again, thoughts make a difference. And so that would be part of what we would talk about. And then the relaxation piece. And that involved relaxation breathing. It involved meditation, which is one of those things that when I say to my clients, I almost always get an eye roll. Or I get, I can't do that. I can't stop my brain from thinking. Which is something I can relate to. And then progressive muscle relaxation. And then we'll do some immediate type feedback stuff. And so we would put a thermometer, tape it to their finger. And so as they're relaxing, we would be measuring their temperature, the distal temperature in their finger. And the more relaxed you are, the warmer your finger gets. I mean, basically, your extremities get warmer. When you're tense, the blood vessels close down, and your extremities, you're not necessarily they get cold, but they are cooler when compared to the rest of the body. And I only say that because it's hot here, so I'm hot. So we are able to, you know, kind of like educate people and talk to them about things that they can do that make a real difference on their experience of their pain. And that is true of psychological pain as well. This works for any pain you experience. It's impossible, really, to separate out the brain or mind and the body, because if your body is suffering and struggling and suffering, then so is your mind. And if the mind is suffering, struggling, so is the body. So there's that connection there always. So I knew. So there was a lot of stuff that I knew. It's just I had not yet taken all that to apply to my clients that I see, or to take like more of a positive spin on everything. But that's what I found I was having to do in order to help decrease the stigma and to help firefighters understand that there are aspects of their stress reaction. I mean, they have no control over it. Like when you are stimulated by some stressor, the body reacts. It is automatic, and you don't have a say in it. It happens. But what you do with that, you do have a say in it. And you also have control over stimulating that alert state or alarm state and stimulating the calming state. So the alarm system, so is the sympathetic nervous system, and the calming system is the parasympathetic nervous system. So we are reacting or being stimulated constantly by different things that are initially perceived at some level as a stressor. And then the body reacts, but it doesn't react to the same degree every time. I mean, there's a variability in that reaction. When you react over and over and over and over and over again and you don't get a chance to calm down, then the baseline that you're reacting from increases, which I have talked about that before. And then it's like everything is a big deal or a bigger deal. So the trick is to have a way to alleviate the response, to stimulate the calming response, to increase your tolerance to those stressors, which is the basis of stress inoculation, is increasing your tolerance for those stressors. So you can make it so that you're not so responsive to those stressors. And one of the things that we do is we train. So the saying, train like you fight and fight like you train. That's why you do that. You know, you're creating muscle memory. You're training your mind and body to react in a way that you don't get, your brain doesn't hijack your body and go full on fight flight mode. So yeah, you still have the alarm system activated. It's just not as big. So there are a lot of things that we do. And so, you know, understanding the physiology of all that is like incredibly helpful. Understanding that mentally, logically, we can change things by how we understand it. So the first thing is like our view on stress. Does stress make you sick or does stress make you stronger? I believe stress makes me stronger. And even before I knew like about all this, it was something that I had decided a long time ago. I'm not quite sure why. It's not like my family was particularly psychologically minded, but it was something that I came to. And it's something that, you know, some people do like come to that. I mean, maybe it's the, you know, being optimistic or being pessimistic. So that might have something to do with it. So, but the fact is that regardless where you are, you could start making that choice. It's not too late. So you can look and understand like that stress response and how it can make you stronger. And that was something that Kelly McGonigal had touched on in her first, and it's something that I am learning now. And this is like right now is just kind of like a personal pursuit to learn more and to supplement what I already know. And I mentioned this guy before, and if you haven't listened to him, I highly recommend that you do. And it's Andrew Huberman. And so he talks about neuroscience and neurobiology, and the way he does is it's pretty amazing. I mean, he explains the mechanism. He throws out some of the big terms, but then he says you don't really need to remember those terms. But he gives you tools that you can utilize to help. So it's like it's great to have the knowledge, but if you have the knowledge and you don't have the tools, then for people like you and me, it doesn't help much. And so I've listened to him, and there's another woman that I listened to. I actually started listening to her first, and it's Stephanie Fay, and she's a neuroscientist. And I started listening to her first, and when she took a hiatus, then that's when I found Dr. Huberman. And then he's part of this group that's like the Flow Institute, involves a bunch of big brains. One of them is the Seahawk psychologist, who's a sports psychologist. And they're all about optimizing human behavior and health and understanding. And Dr. Huberman will talk at the beginning of all of his podcast that, you know, his goal is to provide free information. I mean, he gives a almost 5-minute spiel, talking about his sponsors, which it always sounded like, oh, it took a lot of time. And then I actually looked at the timestamp, and it's always less than 5 minutes. And I'm like, wow, it seems like it's much longer. But I imagine that's how he helps to pay for what is required for him to do these podcasts. But he really wants to provide this information. He wants people to understand the neurobiology and understand that they have some control. So it's like you can't stop. It will happen. You can control how it affects you to some degree. I mean, obviously there's some effects that happen and that's what happens. Like you can't stop the epinephrine discharge from the brain and having that trigger the adrenals, dumping adrenaline. That's going to happen. That's part of the biology of the stress response. But you can actually trigger the calming system. And that was something, I honestly don't remember if I had talked about that last time. John, do you remember? I'm going to ask my memory. Are you listening, John? Hello? Anybody there?
I am. I can hear you now.
Do you remember if last time I talked about like breathing?
Breathing?
Yeah, breathing.
Yes, you did talk about breathing.
Well,
and you were breathing while you were talking about it.
Breathing is important, as we all know.
you talked about the breathing technique.
Okay, so when I guess it would be worth like mentioning it again because it's actually pretty quick and it's a reminder that yes, you can trigger your calming response and it's something that your body does naturally. And now I do remember because I talked about crying. So if you've ever cried and you're trying to like get control of yourself, than you do something like this. It's like, right? So it's basically two big breaths. Well, one big breath in and a second little breath, and then kind of a heavy breath out or a sigh. So he calls it a physiological sigh. So that type of breathing triggers the parasympathetic nervous system, the calming system. And it doesn't, like, it's not like you do that breath a couple times and you feel, you know, light as rain, which I don't really get that statement, but that you feel great again. But what it does is it triggers the calming system so that you can engage your brain and you can then think about whatever it is that you're facing, and you can look at it different and maybe approach it different. Or you can use then some of your other methods for like calming or you know, processing whatever's happening. I mean, it depends on what's going on. But so you can trigger it. So you have that control. And the important thing about the stress response is that when it is happening and it's for like short-term stressors, even if they're severe or critical, your brain stays somewhat engaged and you are performing optimally. But if you have that like accumulation of stress and maybe you haven't been taking care of yourself very well, or you don't have a lot of tools in your toolbox to deal with, you know, work stress, patient stress, call stress, home stress, you know, maybe you don't have enough tools, or maybe the tools you have aren't the right tools, then you obviously, you need to learn a few. So, but that breath can bring you down a notch so that your brain can re-engage. So if you're overstressed and your stress response is heightened because you're not coming back down to like a homeostasis, like that healthy baseline, non-stress baseline, then your brain is not going to engage when you get triggered by stress. And it's going to be that, like you probably have heard the term, lizard brain. You're going to be operating in the lizard brain, and you're going to be essentially responding as if you don't have the capacity for higher order thinking. And so it's important to do what you need to do to re-engage your thinking. And so that breath helps. It re-engages, or it engages, stimulates the calming system so that your brain is re-engaged. That's the purpose of that. So it's not necessarily going to make you feel all wonderful. That's an important thing to know. And it's like that is supported by the knowledge of how stress actually impacts, or the stress response is impacting our body. So when you understand that, you can understand how you can, I think he calls it like hack, so that it works in your favor. The other one, so he'll talk about like if you look at the stress system, our stress system, you know, both sides of it, the alert system and the calming system, you can actually stimulate the alert system so that you could be more awake and energized. Which is something that he talks about is a good thing to do, like after you have learned something. So rather than learning something and going immediately to sleep, he talks about how the research is showing that you learn something and that it actually is encoded much better when your system is in an alert state. And so you can do that by breathing. And one form of breathing is Well, it's basically doing kind of the opposite. I mean, so rather than really engaging your diaphragm when you're breathing out, you're breathing in more forcefully and then out less forcefully and less long. So it's almost hyperventilation. And if you do it, you can actually feel a bit lightheaded, but you feel more energized. And then the other is like with cold therapy. So like taking a cold shower, jumping into a cold lake. Well, let's say let's walk into the cold lake, and other such things. So, you know, putting yourself in that cold state will kind of shock the system and induce that alert state. And then you can always calm it back down with the physiological sigh. And so, you know, he talks about being able to, you know, kind of depending on what you're doing, you can utilize what you know about the body and how the body responds to increase your ability to, like, learn or even to motivate yourself. So I hear a lot, like, when people are really struggling or overstressed, motivation is often a problem. And so when that happens, then I see firefighters, like, not working out anymore. And that sometimes is when they turn into like more alcohol or more marijuana, or there are other things that they might turn to also. And so, it's like there just needs to be, you know, have that understanding and know, you know, that there are things you can do and they're simple. They don't have to be real involved. And so when you see like your motivation waning, you can do that, that breath that makes you more alert. And so I think I'd mentioned last time about the Wim Hof method. That is not something that I do regularly, and I've tried it a few times and it is actually pretty amazing. I can't say, yeah, go do it. It's like one of those things that if you look it up and you find it and you try it, it's basically hyperventilation. but it's something that like free divers will utilize. And the guy who created it, Wim Hof, his actual name, he has a lot of records for doing crazy stuff like swimming, longest free swim under an ice flow. That was one of them and I saw him doing that and I was just like, oh, that makes me cold. But you know, it's that, you know, he puts into practice this breathing and this cold and through his ability to kind of like hack the system, if you will, he can control his perception of that. And this basically is kind of this move in my mind towards, well, let's treat firefighters like elite athletes. What do you think elite athletes are? I mean, I don't think anybody would disagree that it doesn't involve like fitness. It's like there's some fitness involved. I mean, so they have to have like the physical capability of doing whatever sport they're doing. They have to have the motivation and the mental drive to do what it takes to get their body into the state that it needs for that. And they have to be focused on it and they have to be willing to engage in it more than like the average person. And then it also involves, you know, nutrition and sleep and learning and it's possible that, you know, they don't really have the total balance in their life, but they're probably more balanced than a lot of people are. So and you might look at yourself or the person you work with and go, there's no way that guy's an elite athlete. But they can be there, and they can, you know, and they should be there, because the job takes a toll. It's, you know, the calls can take a mental toll. If you're not willing to take a moment, take a breath, and acknowledge that that call was sad and you feel sadness, you're going to struggle. And so that's an important thing. And that is really what it takes to process a call, is acknowledging what you feel about it, being able to put a word to it and acknowledge it and allow yourself to feel it. That's it. That sometimes is all it takes. It's not some big 7-step process or more. It can be as simple as saying, hello, sadness. I see you, I feel you, and I understand why you're here. And that's it. I know it sounds kind of woo-woo, but that really is all it sometimes takes, whatever it is. Or even acknowledging fear or the similarity of the call and how that triggered your own fear response. Because we're all faced with situations in our life, whether it's at work or home or wherever, that can trigger our own sense of mortality, which then triggers a sense of fear or like existential crises. Like, what am I going to do with my life? What's the meaning of my life? What's my purpose? Have I lived my purpose? So it's sometimes it's just acknowledging it, and that's it. Sometimes it might be a bit more involved, but it's like doing that has so much power, because if you compartmentalize or put it in a box or I don't know, stuff it down, put it in a box, compartmentalize, whatever it is that you say, and I've heard those three most often, then you're not really dealing with it. And your brain knows that, and it will exert energy in making sure that you're not actually dealing with it, which is kind of weird, but it will, because it's there. And because you didn't actually tell your brain that you were doing something with it, it will automatically make sure that you're not doing anything with it. So it will check to make sure that you're not thinking about it. So, and that takes energy, and it can, and that over time can take a toll. So you have to acknowledge those things. So acknowledging what you're experiencing. So trying to find some sort of language around emotions. Emotions are not bad. Emotions are pieces of information for us. And we have to listen. So an emotion is basically stimulus. There's a physiological response. And then the brain decides, or, you know, cognitively, the brain is saying, okay, I think we're going to feel this. And sometimes what the brain decides you're feeling is not really all that accurate. And so it's important to recognize what you're feeling and to question if that's in line with what the situation is. So so it all goes back to, like, physiology. So, again, it's understanding the physiology. Physiologically, fear, anger, anxiety, excitement, those four things can actually physiologically feel similar. And so the brain decides what it is. And it will do that by, you know, matching it up against your previous experiences. It will do that by looking to the environment and other people's reactions. So, it's like there's a lot of thought that goes on that we're unaware of. And again, it's like knowing that can actually be really powerful, so that you can be, you know, a bit more focused in and knowing how important the thoughts are with identifying emotions, and then being able to express them. And that's one of the issues in the fire service, obviously, is that there really is not the encouragement to express the emotion, to feel something at a call, because, and I've heard this so often, is that, well, I'm not supposed to feel that. You know, I'm doing a job. I can't feel sad. And it's like, well, you know, feel it now or feel it later, a lot bigger. And that's where we start getting into some of the issues with, you know, possibly developing depression or with, you know, PTSD. And then when we, you know, talk to people about what they're experiencing, if we cannot approach it, sometimes at least from a positive perspective, then people will often internalize it in a way that they can feel really helpless to do anything about it. And the fact is that there's a lot that you can do about it. But it starts with knowledge. You know, knowledge is power. And then knowing some of the things that you can do to help that. And that's where, you know, knowing up front how you can stimulate that parasympathetic nervous system. Knowing the various tools that you can use, you know, later for taking care of yourself. So meditation is great for dealing with all the negative thoughts that can come up. And we have a lot of negative thoughts. First off, we have a lot of thoughts. I mentioned you wouldn't want to be in my head. You probably got a hint of that as I walked through this process. But I came to realize that I have so many thoughts going through my head. When my husband would ask me, what are you thinking? When I was like staring off in space, I used to say nothing because I'm like going, this guy will think I am crazy if I tell him everything going on in my brain. Now, tell him. I give him a little sampling. And sometimes I'll tell him I have, like, you know, this real directed thought, but how I got to it was pretty convoluted. And so I'm pretty sure he might think I'm crazy still. But we have a tendency towards negative thoughts. And I think I mentioned that last time as well. And the thing is that we also have a tendency to believe those negative thoughts. And that's part of our survival mechanism. But we don't have to. We can choose not to. We can challenge those thoughts, which is really at the basis of cognitive behavioral therapy. And then we can choose to think differently. It doesn't always have to be a positive thought. It can be a neutral thought or a more helpful thought. But we got to allow ourselves to recognize those things first. So I'm trying to think of, like, what else? Oh, meditation. That was the other one. That was meditation. When you meditate, you realize how many thoughts you have. And I'm not talking initially about, like, sit down, clear your mind meditation or mantra meditation. It's more of the mindful meditation. So I mentioned it to a guy, a firefighter, and he basically said, well, I don't have time to meditate. I gotta mow my yard, because he's got this big yard. And I go, oh, really? And I go, do you like mowing the yard? And he was like, yeah, most of the time I like mowing the yard. And I go, oh. So do you find yourself, you know, like thinking about stuff? And he's like, no, actually, I don't really think a lot. And I go, oh, so you're not thinking about what you're going to do next? You know, like, oh, when I get done mowing, I got to do X, Y, and Z. And he's like, no. Have you found yourself thinking or worrying about, like, oh, when am I going to be going back to work? And he's like, nope. And I go, what about, like, the past? You know, are you, like, maybe thinking about regrets from the past? And he's like, no. And I go, oh, well, you just meditated. Which he thought was pretty cool. But that's anything can be meditative. But just, you know, mindful meditation is simply, and I know people would, like, go, oh, my God, I can't believe you're explaining it this way. But simply put, without all the extra explanation around it, is, like, being present in whatever you're doing. And then in that process, sometimes you might notice that you have a lot of thoughts, and it's okay. You know, you just come back to whatever it is that you're doing. I mean, your thoughts might not really seem to have much direction, and they could be just kind of there and swirling, or in my case, they float by on clouds. So, you know, the point is that you just bring yourself back, and it brings this understanding of, okay, I have a lot of thoughts, and I actually have a lot of negative thoughts, and I don't really have to believe them. Because I'm like, why do you choose to believe the negative thoughts when you do have positive thoughts too? We don't choose to listen to the positive thoughts. We choose to listen to the negative ones. So you could choose. You know, so it's in that, that's part of our survival mechanism. It's part of that fight, flight, and to survive. It's just that survival doesn't necessarily mean thriving. And we are much happier people when we're thriving. So thriving is, I mean, my understanding to this point, and it could change as I understand more, but to this point, thriving is to me more of a choice. You know, surviving is, it happens. Thriving, you choose. And so that means being purposeful and acting and doing with intention, and having a base knowledge of how things work helps you choose those things, helps you choose in that direction. So that was meditation, and then the relaxation breath can do that, can stimulate us so that we can be more alert and awake. And then there's the breath that we can use to stimulate the calming system. And then there is relaxation breathing, which can help you in the moment as well, but it's more also about, and I think like more along lines of meditation, of like bringing relaxation to the body, and it's more of the long term. I'm working on my brain and my capability to handle myself. So it can be something that can help you get rid of the rocks in the backpack, it can help you get rid of the rocks in the backpack, but you can also increase the capacity of your backpack and your ability to carry it. Because it doesn't matter how strong you are. If you're constantly picking up rocks, eventually you're going to be brought to your knees. And every experience you have is a rock of some varied size. So relaxation breathing is something that can help in the long term, just like meditation, and the research supports this. It can eventually help in the moment if you practice it regularly. Then what happens is it reminds your body what it's like to be relaxed, and then a relaxed state then becomes paired with breath. And so when you take a breath, when you're feeling overwhelmed, then it can bring that relaxed state back into the moment. And so then it can help you. So it's another tool. And so there's, you know, so basically there's a lot of things to do. And there's something physiologically we could do. There's something psychologically we could do. And even our thought process around I can actually do something to help myself helps us. And then, you know, thinking how our mindset, so how we think about stress. So there is truth to that saying, fake it till you make it, because essentially if you're faking it, you are thinking and doing as if you already have this proficiency, and that helps to create the neural pathways necessary to become proficient. So that helps, and that is a thought process and then a doing process. So there's a lot of power in that as well. So we have a lot of control. And so to apply this all to the fire service means, you know, educating people, but not educating them that you're going to experience horrific calls and you're going to develop PTSD, which, honest to God, I heard somebody say that to a group of firefighters, young firefighters. And I'm like, that doesn't help anybody, because if you tell them they're going to get sick from all this stress, they're going to get sick from all this stress unless they have some knowledge and understanding that they can counter that. So we need to tell people, yeah, there's going to be a lot of stressors. The job can be very stressful for a variety of reasons. And life can be stressful for a variety of reasons. And the combination of those can be a bit overwhelming. But you can do something about it. And that's what we need to start saying. And we need to start giving some tools, you know, some of the easy, quick tools, some of the medium-range tools, and then continue to educate people and talk about it. Because the more we talk about it and the more light that is shined on this, the more healthy the fire service will be. And that's what we want to get to, because we're all elite athletes. The job requires us to be, you know, whether you think you are or you think the person next to you is, it doesn't matter. I mean, the job is hard, and you do it without a lot of sleep, and you do it in extreme temperatures, and it requires practice and focus. You're elite athletes. So start taking care of yourself like you're an elite athlete. Start putting the full-on premium gas in, you know, and take care of yourself. And think about yourself in terms of you know, biopsychosocial, spiritual, if you have a spiritual life, because I've seen a lot of people let go of that. So, you know, think about the biology. Understand how the stress response acts. Understand what you can do to hack that response, if you will, which is a phrase that Huberman uses. Understand the psychology. You know, it's like, what are you feeling? What do you think about it? How do you make these assessments or appraisals? What do you learn? Are you adapting? Are you flexible? What's the meaning you make out of it? I mean, so there's a lot that goes in there. So think about that. And then the social is important. And I know I've talked about that. I mean, and there's a lot of research that talks about the social aspects of the fire service. So, you know, make sure that you have a good social network. And if you feel like you're withdrawing from people, then push yourself to get out. Do not withdraw. And I know it's been hard this last year. I feel so incredibly grateful that I had my family that I could be around. I mean, I had my grandkids. Not like I really had a choice. I mean, and I know there were people that did not see their grandchildren. But we created our pod and we stuck to it. And you know, and I'm fortunate to have that. And so, you know, withdrawal has never been an option for me, because I have people around me that would never let me do it. And then spiritual, you know, think about your spiritual life. If you used to go to church and that was important to you, but you found yourself like getting so busy and burned out that you didn't even want to do that, then it might be time to just like push yourself to go back and to, you know, and question why are you not doing it? And then, or maybe you have a different kind of belief and, you know, it's like, how do you give voice to that? I like to go hug trees. So I love nature, and that's kind of spiritual for me. So it's whatever it is for you, you know, it's like find that. And if you don't have that, that's okay. Everybody's going to be different. But, and then, you know, ask yourself, do I love my job? And this was something to be my last thought. Because I was talking to a medical doctor today who runs a wellness clinic, and she works with firefighters. And, we were talking about all this stuff, and you know, in the biopsychosocial model, it's related to, you know, you're looking at it like from a risk and resiliency, or a place of risk and resiliency. So it's like you can have risk in one area and resiliency in the others. It's not like you have to be perfect or resilient all the time across the board. There's a dynamic process that goes on. So it's just knowing what you can affect change with. And so one of the things that she asked me was, you know, why is it that a firefighter can say how much they love the job, but then complain about so many different things? And, you know, it's like they don't like how administration is handling things. They don't like, you know, like they're not feeling supported. There are all these problems that they're facing, and there's no support for that. And she's like, so what is it? Like, how can you love the job but hate so many things? And I told her, I said, well, you know, think about it, you know, with that biopsychosocial model, except this, you're using the risk resiliency. It's like, how much you love your job is the resilience part. All the other stuff that makes you frustrated, that's the risk part. And when the risks become greater than the resilient part, then that's usually when people are at risk of leaving the job, or they're at risk for, you know, getting depressed or anxious or developing PTSD or whatever. It's like, so it's, you know, it's a balance, and it's trying to keep in every aspect the resilience factors higher. And so knowledge is one way to do that. And having conversations about it and understanding the physiology and knowing that you have more control than you think you do. So, you know, that's the goal. It's like nothing's perfect. There's always going to be some fire service. Always going to be something that's going to make you shake your head and go, why am I here? But we don't want you to do that very much. I mean, will you do it? Sure. Yeah. Everybody does that at some given time, regardless of what they're doing. But we want you to have fun. We want you to be healthy. We want people coming in healthy. We want them to do the job and stay healthy. And then we want them to make the choice to retire healthy. And that is the whole purpose of my whole big shift and evolution, if you will, of change and my journey of understanding. So this basically is the direction I'm going, and what excites me the most is that I want people to know that they have some power and some control, and that if I can contribute to them getting to the end of their career and making the choice to retire because they want to retire and they want to go live a healthy, active life and stay all at retirement like my husband, I am all in for that. So I think that's a great place to end. I hope that this all makes sense to you. It made sense to me because it's in my brain, but I want to have a long, healthy career and choose to fail at retirement.
And I've done that so very well.
Yes, you have. And we have a good time at it, right?
We do. We're failing forward.
Yes. So.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Murphy. It was a very enlightening session.
Well, thank you.
Even I
learned. I hope it made
even
sense.
I live with you. It did.
Well, good.
So any final commentary, or are we ready to wrap it up?
No, well, I think I will just say, I want to just mention again, like, if you want to learn some of this stuff that I've been learning, I highly recommend the podcast by Andrew Huberman, and I think it's titled Huberman Labs. If you want to learn about the, you know, neurophysiology of stress and learning and motivation and working out and optimizing your body and body functions and all that stuff, I recommend listening to him. He is very good. Everything he talks about is supported in the research. He'll tell you if it's questionable research or if it's really good research from peer-reviewed journals or whatever. I mean, he's pretty forthcoming with all that stuff, and so I would recommend listening to him. And I didn't mention him per se, but like related to sleep, there's Matthew Walker, and Huberman mentions him, and sleep is really important, and we all know that firefighters can really struggle with sleep, and so that was something we didn't talk to specifically, although Huberman does, you know, kind of hacking the body's physiology in order to optimize sleep and our sleep cycle, even when we're, you know, up all night. And he mentioned Matthew Walker. And so Matthew Walker has a great TED Talk called Sleep. Sleep is My Superpower. I think that's what it's called. And he also has a book, and I can't remember the name of the book, but they're very good and full of, knowledge. And some practical things that you can do to help. So I would recommend those two highly. So that's it.
All right. Well, without further ado, good night, everyone. We'll see you all at FDIC August 2nd through the 7th. For those rescuers in Miami-Dade, be careful, be safe. Prayers and blessings with you all. And for the rest of our country, sleep well. Until next time, Dr. Beth Murphy.
Thank you and good night.